the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Five Live News with Dina Campbell. It's 6 o'clock. The British boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF World Heavyweight title with a brutal fifth round knockout of Anthony Joshua. More on that in sport in a moment with James Gregg. In other news, Sir Keir Starmer says it's his job to do something about leaks from his government. It comes after a number of Whitehall sources told the BBC earlier this week that his top adviser, Sue Gray, was paid more than him, amid signs of disquiet in his top ranks. The Prime Minister spoke ahead of Labour's first party conference in government in 15 years. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, looks ahead to what to expect from the gathering in Liverpool.
Today, the Labour conference begins in earnest, with the Deputy Prime Minister due to take the stage. Angela Rayner will promise to improve housing standards. The party is keen to reset the narrative after days of questions about gifts and the pay of senior Downing Street advisers. But there is still some tension over Labour's economic and policy direction. Today, the union, Unite, will press forward with its motion on the winter fuel allowance. With recent government warnings about further tough choices to come, the Prime Minister told the Sunday Mirror his government was not going down the road of austerity.
The leader of the Unite Union says she'll use the Labour Party conference to try to persuade Sir Keir Starmer to scrap plans to remove the winter fuel payment from most pensioners. Sharon Graham told the BBC that if Keir Starmer could change his mind and refuse future gifts of clothes, he could change his mind on cutting the payment from millions of pensioners. The Crown Prosecution Service says it twice considered bringing charges against the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, but on both occasions it concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. Dozens of women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by the billionaire, who died last year. Nick Johnson has more.
In 2009, the Crown Prosecution Service was handed a file of evidence by police who'd investigated claims that Mr. Al-Fayed had sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl in the boardroom at Harrods. The CPS declined to bring charges. Now, as first reported by the Sunday Times, it's been confirmed the CPS also decided in 2015 not to prosecute the billionaire after reviewing an allegation of rape. In a statement, the CPS said that in both cases, it did not feel confident there was a realistic prospect of conviction.
Israel has imposed restrictions on civilian movements in the north of the country in case Hezbollah retaliates against its airstrikes on southern Lebanon. The authorities in Beirut say 37 people were killed on Friday in an attack on what Israel says was a Hezbollah stronghold. The broadcaster Al Jazeera says Israeli forces have raided its offices in the occupied West Bank. The Qatari-owned network said it's been ordered to shut operations there for 45 days. And now for sport, as promised, with James Gregg.
Dina, thank you very much indeed. As mentioned, it was Daniel Dubois who retained that IBF World Heavyweight title with that brutal fifth round knockout of Anthony Joshua at Wembley in front of 96,000 fans. And of course, Dubois dominated that bout. He dropped Joshua to the canvas several times en route to that victory. Liverpool, meanwhile, sit top of the Premier League table ahead of Manchester City and Aston Villa on goal difference. City do, though, have a game in hand. Of course, that comes later on. They play against Arsenal this afternoon. Luis Diaz did score twice for Liverpool in that 3-0 win over Bournemouth yesterday. Villa came from a goal down to win 3-1 at home to Wolves. There were also wins yesterday for Chelsea, Tottenham and Fulham. In the Scottish League Cup, Aberdeen beat fourth-tier Spartans 4-0, and Rangers, on their return to Ibrox for the first time this season, beat Dundee 3-0. In the second one-day international at Headingley, England were all out for 202, leaving Australia the winners by 68 runs. Australia now lead that five-match series 2-0. And there's more sport in half an hour and in breakfast, of course. But for now, it's time for Five Live Science.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, welcome to Five Live Science from the Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith. And coming up this week, What do we know about the pagers and walkie-talkies that have been used to attack Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon? Also, the landmark study on the impact of pregnancy on the female brain, and how scientists in Israel have grown a 1,000-year-old seed that might fill in a missing link in the Bible. Plus, the engineers who are finding fresh solutions to the problem of climate change.
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live.
We begin with reports that Israel's spy agency, Mossad, is responsible for detonating explosives hidden inside pagers and walkie-talkies that were used by the Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon. The blasts that came within a day of each other have killed more than 20 people and left thousands more injured. The attacks follow the resumption of Hezbollah's long-standing rancor with Israel, with hostilities increasing dramatically since the start of the war in Gaza. So what do we know about the targeting of these tech devices inside Lebanon? Will Tingle has been speaking with Scott Lucas at University College Dublin's Clinton Institute, where Scott is also the founder and editor of EA Worldview, a world-leading website on international affairs.
On September 17th, across Lebanon, a text message was sent to thousands of pagers that belonged to members of Hezbollah. When people looked at that text message, in fact, there was a tiny amount of explosive in the pagers that detonated, which meant that at least 12 people were killed, almost 3,000 wounded, many of them suffering hand injuries from holding the pagers or eye injuries because, of course, they were looking at the screen. We thought that would be the full story. But then on September 18th, the same type of operation was carried out through walkie-talkies that, again, were believed to be used by Hezbollah members. So we are at a point where, having abandoned the use of cell phones because they could be tracked, Hezbollah now finds itself vulnerable with almost any form of communication.
I suppose that's important to clarify from the get-go, is that these walkie-talkies and pagers had an extra element added to them, and that people who own these devices outside of Lebanon are not in any danger.
No, we do need to make clear that this was not a fault of the devices, the pagers, the walkie-talkies, which means that we have a general threat to people outside of Lebanon. We can now piece the story together in terms of why there was a specific threat. In other words, this explosive, we think about 3 grams of explosive in each of them. Now, of course, the Israelis wouldn't send this to Hezbollah and say, here you go, use them. They were sent through a front company. But when Hezbollah received them, they simply thought, oh, this is an order that we had placed with this company that we thought was a legitimate company that had no connection with Israel. They would have no reason to think that the pagers had been doctored. We don't know the full details yet on the walkie-talkies, but it looks like that there was a similar operation. This was an elaborate operation that would have taken many, many months, involving the setting up of at least 3 front companies, involving setting up a production capability, involving setting up a supply chain, all for one single purpose: to make walkie-talkies, to make pagers, not for the general market, but to get them into the hands of Hezbollah members and then to wreak havoc when they exploded.
You touched on it before, but why were Hezbollah resorting to using walkie-talkies and pagers?
The immediate conflict that we have between Israel and Lebanese organization Hezbollah has escalated since last October 7th alongside Israel's military operations in Gaza, because Israel has carried out targeted assassinations that have killed leaders of Hezbollah as well as leaders of the Palestinian organization Hamas. The Hezbollah overall leader, Hassan Nasrallah, ordered Hezbollah members to stop using cell phones because cell phones enable people to track you. When you use a pager, it reduces your, let's say, your communications toolbox, but it also limits the possibility of surveillance. So Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, had issued that order to stop using cell phones, believing it would increase their security, their operational security. But of course, because the Israelis knew he had issued this order, they immediately started looking at the alternative, which is, can we penetrate the pagers? Can we strike Hezbollah through that?
Do we know what the effect on the communications network is going to be in Lebanon? Because obviously people are going to be shying away from pagers and walkie-talkies for the time being, but there are places like hospitals for which those devices are pretty essential.
I mean, there was a clear signal just after the pager explosions took place of this widespread effect and how this is an attack that doesn't just simply target Hezbollah. It affects communications inside a country which is economically crippled and faces security threats. The United Nations told its staff, you know, staff who are there to assist people in Lebanon in the midst of an economic emergency, a social emergency, that's it. Don't use your phones. Other organizations have done the same thing. You know, the Israelis are trying to reduce Hezbollah to an early 20th century state by removing the modern means of communications upon which we rely.
Scott Lucas at University College Dublin's Clinton Institute, who is speaking to Will Tingle. Detailed brain scans of a mother before, during and after pregnancy have revealed stark changes in the size and connectivity of many brain regions, particularly those related to socialising and emotional processing. The study, which has been published in Nature Neuroscience, claims to be one of the first comprehensive maps of the brain during the 9-month gestation period. And with some 85% of women falling pregnant at some point in their lives, some say proper research into this area is long overdue. Scientists suspect that the changes relate to pruning down connections within the brain, perhaps optimising the way that some brain areas communicate with one another, possibly to facilitate mother-baby bonding or caregiving, for example. Well, here to tell us more is the lead author, Laura Pritchett, who's a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania.
What we know thus far in the existing literature is based on experiments that have done sort of a snapshot approach, where we have taken women before they're going to try to become pregnant and scan their brain, looking at a bunch of details of their gray matter, their white matter, fluid in their brain. And then we will bring them back and scan them again early postpartum when they've just delivered. And that is really interesting, and it provides the strongest evidence to date that neural changes are happening from that time where they're trying to become pregnant to delivering a baby. There are these gray matter reductions from pre to post pregnancy, and those reductions can persist up to 6 years postpartum. And that includes cortical gray matter volume. It includes the thickness of the cortical sheet, which is that outer layer of the brain. But the outstanding question was, what does that pace of change, what does that time course of those reductions look like?
Indeed. And is it uniform across pregnancy, or are there surges in cortical loss and then it settles down? So how did you actually go about doing this, and who did you study?
What we've done in the last decade or so is really put that spotlight back on the individual, asking, are we representative of ourselves at a single time point? And in fact, that temporal flow, those fluctuations in our day-to-day life could be reflected in the brain, and that's not something we're capturing. And so they've turned to this sort of precision imaging, dense sampling approach, where now we're bringing in fewer samples of people, but scanning them and studying them over long periods of time and getting a lot of phenotypic data on them, meaning we can study their mood, we can get their blood, we can ask them a ton of questions and get a lot of information on the individual. So we had a volunteer, she's a co-senior author on this paper, Liz Krostel. She's a professor at the University of California, Irvine. We scanned her brain 3 weeks before she began IVF all the way through 2 years postpartum.
Was this with MRI, magnetic resonance imaging?
Yes, a 30 to 45 minute brain scan with MRI.
And this enabled you to get the gross anatomy. What did that show you? Was there any particular hot spot in pregnancy when things changed, or was it just a gradual change? And if you map that onto what's happening to her hormones, is there a correlation?
Yes, all great questions. And it actually, the answer differs when you think about different metrics of brain anatomy. So with respect to starting with gray matter volume, the brain metric that has been studied the most, this is where the cell bodies live, the neurons, we found this sort of linear decline. Gray matter volume was reducing as gestational week was advancing and sex hormones were rising. That was pretty widespread. 80% of the brain regions we looked at showed that sort of relationship. There wasn't any sort of big inflection point. And then in postpartum, those gray matter volume reductions bounced back a little bit, but they did not return to baseline levels. And we see the same pattern for cortical thickness. So you've got the actual volume, the area within those regions, and you have the thickness of the cortex itself. Those are really tied metrics to each other. However, At the same time, you can think of this as, well, if a tissue in my brain is reducing, something's got to fill that space. We're not walking around with these sort of holes in our brain. And that's what we saw. We saw cerebral spinal fluid increase over pregnancy. We saw lateral ventricles expand during pregnancy. And it just shows this beautiful choreographed dance of what's changing over this period. Now, one of the most interesting and I would argue novel findings here is that we also had our subject do what we call as a diffusion imaging scan, which allows us to capture information on white matter tracts in the brain, which is the myelinated axons that are facilitating communication between neuron A and neuron B. And what we found is that the integrity of that white matter was increasing over pregnancy, and it peaked in the second trimester. So it showed sort of a non-linear rise over pregnancy. And again, there are some caveats to us talking about those inflection points and pace when we're speaking about only a single subject. But that is very interesting to us because of the articles that have looked pre-post pregnancy and done those same sorts of metrics looking at white matter microstructure, they didn't find any differences. And that could be due to us not capturing that big metamorphosis in the brain because we didn't look within gestation itself.
Laura Pritchett there. Researchers in the United States have developed an imaging agent that can track down deposits in the body of the relatively common fungal infection aspergillosis, which can spell disaster, especially for patients with compromised immune systems. The study that was carried out on mice has recently been published in the journal Science Translational Medicine, and it hinges on using a small radioactive-labelled sugar molecule that the fungus can take up and digest, but which our own tissues can't use. As such, it concentrates at the sites of fungal infections, and it produces a hotspot that a PET scanner can see. Dima Hamoud is the brain behind the breakthrough, and she's at the NIH Clinical Center.
Aspergillus is actually found everywhere in the environment. We do inhale it every day, but because we have a competent immune system, we are able to eliminate that microbe immediately before it starts germinating and growing. But when those patients with weak immune systems inhale aspergillus, the spores are not efficiently eliminated, and then they start growing and they start invading and become deadly infections. So it's very important in those situations to actually diagnose fungal infections really early on, because you want to start them on treatment very fast, as soon as possible, and that will give you the best results.
And where does your work fit into that?
I am a radiologist, and my research is in PET imaging, which is short for positron emission tomography. And the reason we were first interested in this is because fungal infections are very difficult to diagnose. So if you do a CT scan or MRI, you might not be able to differentiate a fungus from a bacterium, and then you don't really know what to treat them with. Also, you might need biopsies, or you need to be really invasive to get those. So that's what kind of prompted us to think of a non-invasive study, like an imaging method, that will tell us specifically if there are fungal infections in those patients. And if there are, we can start treatment really rapidly and get better results.
So almost like a marker that will flag up where they are if they're there and make them go on like a bright red warning light to you, the radiologist.
Yeah, so a lot of people, especially cancer patients, are very familiar with PET imaging because they get something called FDG PET. And FDG is essentially a molecule, it's a glucose molecule that somebody added a radioactive tag to. And what happens in cancer patients, you inject FDG and then you do the scanning and then you detect where it went because it has a radioactive signal. So what we wanted to do is to develop something similar to FDG, but that thing, instead of detecting tumors, it will actually go after fungi like aspergillus, as I said, because it's one of the worst fungi to infect immunosuppressed patients.
So how do you target it in that way? What have you exploited about the fungus that means you can do that?
We looked very carefully at what fungi eat. Fungi are everywhere in the environment, and they have to survive. It's not always easy to find food. So as a result, they evolve to be able to use sugars other than glucose, especially those found in plants. And those are really very complex sugars called cellulose, which are like sheets of sugars. So fungi actually dissolve those sugars by using special enzymes into smaller pieces. And smaller. The last sugar in this reaction is one called cellobiose. So when we started looking at aspergillus, we thought cellobiose might be a good idea because essentially it's made of two glucose molecules that are very strongly tied together. So much so that humans and other microbes like bacteria cannot break the bond between the two glucose molecules. Only certain fungi, on the other hand, like Aspergillus, can break cellobiose into two glucose molecules because they have those enzymes. So we thought if we actually can take this molecule, cellobiose, and attach a radioactive tag to it, and then inject it in mice that have fungal infections, we should be able to see if it's broken into glucose and FDG by using a PET scanner. The PET scanner we use is actually a small kind of a miniature scanner from the human one. It's only for mice and rats. So what we do is we infect the mice, and then we image them after we inject our molecule. And then we had another group of mice that were infected with bacteria, different types of bacteria, and then another group of mice that had inflammation, which is non-infectious. So we injected our molecule, the cellobiose molecule, which has a radioactive tag on it, in those animals, and we imaged them. And we found that only the animals with fungal infection are the ones that had radioactivity. All the other animals just injected that thing in and it went immediately out. There was no accumulation. So that confirmed our theory that only fungi, specifically Aspergillus in this case, are capable of breaking cellobiose. And that's why you get this accumulation of radioactivity.
And you're comfortable that that is not harmful. When you inject that, it's not going to cause some kind of side reaction or problem for the person who ultimately might end up having it injected into them.
This is the basis of PET imaging. Anything we inject, including FDG, has to be in very, very small amounts. It's so small that it can never affect any organ or anything happening, any process, either in the animals or in patients. FDG, for example, it's injected in very, very tiny amounts. And the same is the same case with cellobiose.
So is the basis of this that if you have a deposit of fungi somewhere, because they are capable of metabolizing this stuff, they're going to accumulate it. So you inject it, it goes all around the body, but where the fungi are, they're going to grab it, hold on to it and start to break it down. And that's why you get a hot spot on your PET scan where they are.
When we inject it, it's in the blood, so it goes everywhere. But wherever it runs into Aspergillus, into a fungus, the fungus notices it and then starts producing that enzyme, breaks it, and then takes it in. And that's why it accumulates. While bacteria, they see it, but they can't do anything about it. So it just goes away.
Dima Hamoud at the NIH Clinical Center talking about her study out recently in Science Translational Medicine. Now, have you ever wondered whether science could allow us to bring back an ancient species from the dead? Well, Sarah Sallon and her colleagues in Israel have been doing precisely that for the plant world. The evidence speaks for itself in the form of a long-forgotten plant that actually has biblical roots. Now, I first met Sarah about 20 years ago when she was working on growing ancient date stones dating back 2,000 or so years, spat out by someone a long time ago in the Middle East, and since uninterred in archaeological digs. Well, now, with another ancient seed she's found in a university collection from another archaeological dig, she's branched out into a different part of the plant family tree, the one that includes myrrh and frankincense, and she's grown something else extraordinary.
The seed that was discovered was not a date seed like the last time. It was another seed, but we didn't know what it was. No one could identify it. So it was popped in the earth by my colleague, Elaine, and up came something that really was very surprising, and we didn't know what it was. We sent pictures all over the world, and one very clever botanist from Arizona Botanical Garden said, "Hey, that's a commiphora." And I said, "What?" He said, "You know, commiphora, the family of frankincense and myrrh." I said, "Oh, that commiphora." So that's how it began.
Did the people who dug up the seed realise what it was? And why on earth would it end up in your hands and then going in a pot to grow?
The seed was discovered around 40 years ago when archaeologists from the Hebrew University were exploring caves in the Judean desert. And when you explore caves in the Judean desert, you often find what they call botanical material, lots of seeds. And the archaeologists sort of take them, put them in little boxes, and store them at the university. And, you know, they don't really bother to identify them. So that seed was in a little box at the Hebrew University, and I asked the archaeologist if I could have a look at his boxes, and he said, sure, take whatever you want. So I went through the boxes, and when I was doing it, I found some very nice date seeds, and I found this seed that was in beautiful condition. I didn't know how old it was, but it was in the cave, and I took that, and I gave it to Elaine, and she planted them. So the date story, we already know that a few of those came up, and this other unknown seed came up too.
How do you know how old it is, and indeed, how old is it?
As it was pushing out of the seed, the stalk, if you like, it pushed off the seed cap. It was like a little cap on it. It's called the operculum. And she very cleverly took that little seed cap and put it in a little paper bag and gave it to me. And I sent it off to the radiocarbon testing lab in Switzerland, in Zurich, Professor Marcus Egli, whose lab does that. And they came back with a date of about 1,000 years ago.
What does it look like? Is it a tree that's come up? And how old?
It's a tree, yeah.
Yeah, how old is it now? Because you did this a little while ago, because obviously you're reporting on what you have now done.
The family of frankincense and myrrh, they're called Berceraceae. And the Commiphora, which is a kind of myrrh, is one of that family. But there's 200, actually, types of Commiphora. Myrrh is just one. So what we did is we took leaves and we tested them to see what kind of Commiphora it was. Was it a myrrh? Was it something else? And the Commiphora are very different. Some of them are quite tall trees. Some of them are more like shrubby bushes. They really differ. There's maybe 200 members in that, what we call that genus. We sent them to Professor Andrea Weeks at George Mason University in the US, and she is probably the world's expert on Commiphora. The name Commiphora means giving resin. And she said, well, I've got about 109 specimens of this Commiphora from different types, including myrrh, but your one isn't like any of them.
Is that because she's got what we call extant species, things you'd find in the world today, and yours is one that's gone extinct or isn't grown anywhere anymore? So she just hasn't come across that. Is that one possible explanation?
One possible explanation is that it's extinct and it doesn't grow anywhere. And the other possibility, of course, is that she hasn't got all of the Commiphora in the world, and maybe it's still hiding somewhere away and no one's ever collected it or tested it. Because I said there's about 200 species, and she's got, you know, samples of maybe over half of them. But maybe it's the other half that she hasn't got. So we don't know. But until today, nowadays, in Israel, there are no species like this that have existed, not for hundreds and hundreds of years. We know that.
Would this have biblical relevance then, given it's in that family and it's in that part of the world? Is there a potentially religious connection here?
Well, that's the interesting thing, you see, because in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, there's something in the book of Genesis which Jacob, you've heard of Jacob, he gives to his sons as a present to Pharaoh when the sons are going back to Egypt. And he says, give them a little what he called tsori in Hebrew. And no one ever really knew what it was. In Hebrew, it means to drip, something that drips. And it was assumed that this was some very valuable resin material. And we know from other parts of the Bible, particularly from the books of the prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, that this tsori was associated with the land of Gilead, which actually is on the other side of the Jordan and is now in the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. So Gilead and tsori were connected. There was something, a tree there, that produced a resin, and it was very valuable. It was also connected with healing, and it's disappeared. And no one has really ever decided what it was. And we think that maybe what we grew is the tsori. And one of the reasons we think so is because some very clever chemists in France and in Australia tested the resin and found loads of compounds which are very medicinal.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. Sarah Salen there at the Hadassah Medical Center in Jerusalem. And those findings have just come out in Communications Biology. And now it's time for the news and sport. But after that, we're going to be asking what engineers have got up their sleeves to help us with the solutions to the climate crisis.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. Sir Keir Starmer says it's his job to do something about leaks coming from government after the salary of his chief adviser, Sue Gray, was made public earlier this week. He spoke ahead of the start of the Labour Party conference, which begins in Liverpool today. And the CPS says it twice failed to bring charges against Mohamed Al-Fayed. Fresh allegations are being made about the late billionaire, sparked by dozens of women coming forward to say they were raped or sexually assaulted by the former owner of Harrods. Sport now with James Gregg.
Dina, thank you very much indeed. It was a fight in front of 96,000 fans at Wembley Stadium and a worldwide television audience. The IBF title holder Daniel Dubois was considered to be the outsider against the favourite, the two-time unified world champion, Anthony Joshua. But Dubois, who inherited the crown after Alexander Usyk was forced to vacate, stopped Joshua with a brutal knockout in round five.
No, I'm a gladiator, I'm just a warrior to the end, to the bitter end, and I'm just ready to go. You know, I want to go to the top level of this game and reach my full potential.
More reaction, of course, on the BBC Sports website and on the 5 Live Boxing podcast that's out now. Football-wise, the Liverpool boss Arne Slot claims it wasn't easy for his team as they went top of the Premier League on goal difference yesterday. They beat Bournemouth at Anfield.
I felt that it was a tougher game than the 3-0 scoreline maybe have looked like, because Bournemouth just kept on going. And there might be a reason for this, because I know they were 2-0 down after 87 minutes, a few miles further north, south, I don't know. But they just kept on going, so it was a tough match till the end. But what pleased me most was the way we played with the ball.
Aston Villa are level on points with Liverpool and Manchester City at the top. Villa won 3-1 at home to Wolves yesterday. Of course, City do have that game in hand, but that's against Arsenal later on. There were wins for Tottenham over Brentford and for Fulham over Newcastle. Chelsea had a 3-0 success at West Ham in the early game. Leicester against Everton and Southampton versus Ipswich both ended one apiece. Manchester United drew, of course, goalless with Palace. In the Scottish Premiership, St Mirren beat Hearts 2-1 yesterday. Ross County and managerless St Johnston drew 3-3. The quarterfinals of the Scottish League Cup saw Aberdeen defeat the fourth-tier Spartans 4-0. And on their return to Ibrox for the first time this season, Rangers beat Dundee 3-0. A thrilling finish beckons for the final day of the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth. Rory McIlroy hit a round of 66 to climb to 15 under par. He's joint second. That's three shots, though, behind the Italian Matteo Manassero, who soared to 18 under yesterday. Manassero carded an eagle and seven birdies.
I know what I'm doing much more, I think. I have a better perspective about golf and being in a top of leaderboards, but it's never that comfortable. It's not easy to compete against such a high level in tough conditions. It's not easy, but that's what we work for and that's what we try and achieve days like this. Yeah, I'm just happy where I am.
And there was defeat for England in the second one-day international at Headingley yesterday. They were dismissed for 202, leaving Australia the winners by 68 runs. 2-0 up they are now in that five-match series. Game three takes place tomorrow. Now for some more 5 Live science.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Exciting times in F1.
This afternoon from 1.
Marina Bay Street Circuit.
Singapore.
Can Red Bull turn around their fortunes on a track that they haven't got good history at? Or are McLaren in a league of their own now?
Listen to live coverage of every lap
on 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
Welcome back to 5 Live Science with me, Chris Smith, from The Naked Scientists. And today we are exploring the role of engineers in tackling climate change. The United Nations recently described climate change as the defining crisis of our time, and one that's happening even more quickly than it could possibly have predicted. The burning of fossil fuels, deforestation, industry and overpopulation have certainly all played a major part in forcing global temperatures to rise. This has ultimately led to more extreme weather events, rising sea levels and the destruction of natural habitats. Policymakers have often dragged their feet in a bid to halt these seismic changes. But, as the UN points out, we are not powerless to stop it, and science is increasingly coming up with new ways to tackle the problem. We're going to be examining some of the more innovative ways that researchers are engineering solutions to the climate crisis over the course of today's programme. And to help us out first, though, here's Mark Maslin, who's a professor of climate change at UCL and also the author of How to Save Our Planet.
Last year, 2023, was the warmest year on record, hitting average of 1.48 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But even worse, if we look at the last 12 months, we have gone past the 1.5 degree target, which was set up by the Paris Agreement in 2015 by the leaders of the world. And the problem is that we haven't turned the corner. 2023 was the year when we emitted the most greenhouse gases ever in recorded history.
People often liken climate change to an oil tanker. Probably quite a difficult analogy to use, isn't it, given what's in the oil tanker? But the point being that this has a lot of momentum. And when you want to stop the tanker, you don't turn the engine off at port because you will crash. You turn it off out at sea and you aim to coast to a stopping point. So how far do we think the climate juggernaut is going to coast? Even if we do all these things now, how bad are things going to get?
We know if we stopped putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere tomorrow, the temperature would stabilize where it is now. Great. The problem is, and I love your analogy of the oil tanker, the societies we live in have a predisposition to actually use fossil fuels because everything's built on it. The oil companies are making huge amounts of money. Countries are making tax dollars from those oil companies, and therefore people are very reticent to actually move away from this cash cow. And also, what I really like to point out to people is the International Monetary Fund monitors the amount of taxpayers' money that is subsidizing fossil fuel companies. And last year, it came out about $1 trillion. That is about half the GDP of the United Kingdom. Every single year is being given straight to the oil and the gas companies to pollute our atmosphere, which we, the taxpayer, will then have to pay to fix.
We're going to hear a bit later on about making concrete in a more environmentally kind way, but that's going to be a big headache, isn't it? Because if we have to rehouse a large proportion of the population, if that's what you're saying is the engineering challenge that confronts us, then that's a lot of cement and that's an enormous carbon footprint.
So we have a look at cement now. If cement itself was a country, it would be the sixth largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. But it's also absolutely essential. So what we need to do is think about ways that we can use technology to make it less polluting. Instead of just damning things and going, do you know what, concrete, awful, we shouldn't use it. No, but we should make it better.
What about energy sources and energy transmission? There've got to be some wins there. People keep talking about, for instance, a re-evaluation of nuclear and the concept of small modular reactors, that kind of thing. Do you think that is worth considering?
I think the key technology will be, in the second half of this century, fusion. Now, fusion, the scientists have done their jobs. We have the actual scientific understanding and we've created more energy than we put in. What is now the problem is it's a massive, and I mean a massive engineering problem. How do you take the laboratory and scale it up? Now, the UK government has set aside land and money to try and build the first fusion sort of reactor in Nottingham, but it's going to take huge amounts of new engineering. to actually produce that.
Mark Maslin, author of How to Save Our Planet, on why tackling climate change is chiefly an engineering problem. And indeed, across the rest of the programme, we're going to explore some of those engineering answers, which also include building superior ways to monitor climate change and our progress against stopping it. And in this regard, the UK's Advanced Research and Invention Agency, or ARIA, recently announced that it's allocating £80 million to a new programme that aims to create early warning systems for climate tipping points. These tipping points get their name because, if crossed, they can trigger abrupt and irreversible onward changes to the Earth's climate. ARIA hopes to bring together the best and the brightest scientists in the world to predict when they might happen, so we can do something about them. To find out more, I went to see Sarah Bondique, the programme director at ARIA and a professor of biomedical physics at the University of Cambridge. What, I wanted to know first, constitute these climate tipping points?
For example, we might think about the melting of an ice sheet that would contribute significantly to sea level rise. Or we might think of about the collapse of an ocean circulation that could shift the position of the jet stream, change the weather in various parts of the world, which would lead to problems with agriculture, biodiversity, impacts on food security. These things are happening on timescales that are still unfolding.
And is the purpose of the project to identify what those tipping points are? To actually make a shopping list of them so we know what to look for and therefore can size up the risk?
In our programme, we're looking at how we might understand when those tipping points would occur, over what timescales they might unfold, and what the consequences of crossing them would be. At the moment, we have a pretty good understanding of which parts of the Earth system are prone to undergoing this kind of tipping between different stable states. But what we're lacking is the ability to detect when this is coming. We know that some systems are undergoing significant changes at the moment. But the question is, do these changes commit us to, for example, the entire loss of an ice sheet? And we have two major challenges that are preventing us from getting to that point. One is the data. If we think about weather forecasting, we can do that with pretty good accuracy because we have an abundance of data. We're very good at knowing when a heat wave is coming, when a major storm is coming. If we try to think about when a tipping point is coming, often these things are in incredibly harsh environments. If we're talking about ice sheets, we're talking about extremely cold in remote places, which are very hard to make measurements in. So we have a real scarcity of data, not just on a day-to-day basis, but also long-term records going back decades or centuries. Earth is such a complex and variable system. If we want to detect these changes, then we would need to have a really long record of data from which we could detect these subtle changes that we are approaching a tipping point. The other problem is a modelling problem. We have extremely sophisticated climate models that teach us about how the climate is changing over time, how different systems interact with each other. But these are hugely computationally challenging. Despite their incredible sophistication, they don't always include all of the processes that we would need in order to describe these tipping processes, understanding how we cross tipping points. On top of that, they're very computationally expensive. Being able to calculate a trajectory for how the climate might evolve over the coming decades or centuries takes an incredible amount of computational power. As a result of that, it's also quite hard to integrate observations that we're getting every day around the world. We're setting out to try and see whether it would be possible to set up an early warning system that unites modelling and measurements and helps us to understand better when these tipping points are likely to arise.
It's really interesting that the policy has taken you in this direction. We've basically arrived at a situation where we have researchers, scientists, using scientific insight, but to run a programme like this and have resource behind them to fund other people to get involved, instead of relying on all those individuals to come together independently under some kind of government policy or something. That's quite an interesting and innovative way of doing things.
It's a really key part of the ARIA model is to put people first, then projects. And that starts with recruiting us as programme directors and giving us that blank slate to go out into the community and find out what are the big problems of today and how can we reach for the edge of the possible to try and tackle them. In talking to the climate science community, we really identified these gaps in observations in harsh environments and also these challenges with building up the next generation of models. And we felt that we could really push this forward if we were able to build up a program around early warning of tipping points that integrated both of those things together. So having that scientist lens means that we can understand what some of the challenges are in building new sensors. What does it take to get a new measurement at the deepest depths of the ocean? What does it take to take a picture with a camera if you're out in the Arctic Circle, for example? Those are things that we've both worked on in our backgrounds as physicists, so we have an understanding of some of those challenges, but we've never thought about them in the context of climate science before.
Sarah Bondiek, the programme director at ARIA and biomedical physics professor at the University of Cambridge. We were hearing earlier from Mark Maslin that our infrastructure, things like our ageing housing stock and our built environment, poses a huge problem when it comes to climate change. In a bid to redress some of the problems that concrete causes, Alelia Keir, who's a materials scientist and engineer at Imperial College London, has developed a version of it that tackles one of the other major challenges that are predicted to come with climate change: altered rainfall patterns and more extreme weather. This all adds up to requiring better stewardship in the future of our water. At the moment, as cities expand and we concrete over the countryside, we render the ground below impervious to rainfall, which all hits the sewers in one giant rush and then causes flooding and is also lost, ultimately, out to sea. The earth below is progressively deprived of water that would previously have soaked in and restocked groundwater. So Alelia's eponymous product, which has been developed with the help of UK Research and Innovation and also the Royal Academy of Engineering, is called Keircrete. And it's concrete with holes through it that allow water to run through so it can be captured and used, and also soak into the ground like a sponge, so a deluge doesn't turn into a flood.
There are a number of different challenges that the engineers are facing today, including decarbonisation, ensuring that the UK hits its national carbon targets. And also another problem is flooding. So we need to not only ensure that we reduce our carbon footprint of our flood management interventions to contribute to net zero targets, but also we need to ensure that our infrastructure are capable to cope with more extreme weather events.
Is there anything we can do about that problem of the fact that concrete is largely impervious and the water that lands on it runs straight off and goes down the drain? Is there a better way of doing that?
So one of the ways is to ensure that pavement infrastructure is permeable, is able to allow the water to go through it and to prevent that nuisance to the society, and also that water is then used in a more clever way rather than the way it is now, which just ends up into the drainage network and causes more problems down the line.
And how can we do that? Because isn't one of the major things about concrete the wonderful aspect of it, that it's incredibly strong, you can put massive loads on it, but in order to achieve that, you have to have something which effectively is solid rock?
To achieve a high strength, you don't necessarily have to be completely impermeable. So what we have been trying to do is to come up with a pavement structure that essentially has a lot of channels in it that would allow that water to drain through it. So it still will have the same strength as your traditional impermeable concrete surfaces, but it has the added benefit that it has a really high permeability or drainage ability that eliminates flooding and stormwater runoff, and also improves the splash and spray related visibility issues, and it reduces weather related accidents. So it eventually enhances the societal safety.
I'm just picturing this in my mind. So is it effectively a mould then with lots of holes, and you put concrete into that mould, and that means that you get concrete with holes in it, which then allow the water to go vertically through the concrete layer? But because the concrete's still all connected together, it's still strong, but it's got channels in it.
That's essentially it. You're essentially picturing a solid concrete that has a lot of holes in it, as you mentioned earlier, a formwork that has all of these interconnected channels that would allow the water to go down vertically, but also the material has a really high strength that can sustain the loads of an aircraft or vehicular loads or pedestrian loads or cyclist loads.
And when you say you can capture and therefore repurpose the water that goes down those holes, is that because there's some way or some system of collecting what's come through the holes underneath? So would you lay the concrete on something that's capable of acting as a conduit for that water, which is how you grab it?
Yes. So essentially the pavement surfaces are typically built on what we call a porous substructure. So we're talking about just stones. And those, the water would go through those stones and then it goes into what is called a storage tank. So this storage tank would, first of all, delay the water and prevent the water from going into the drainage network and causing flooding downstream. But also that water that is within that tank could be used for irrigation purposes, or it could even, depending on the area that is built in, it could go into the ground and recharge the groundwater table.
And the cost implication, because the one thing that developers are always going to look at is the bottom line, because you're using less concrete because you've got the holes in the way, does that actually translate into a saving?
So when you look at the cost, we need to look at the whole life cost of the pavement structure. So the initial cost in terms of the labour cost is similar to the traditional pavement surfaces. But when you look at the whole life cost, it's actually much cheaper than the traditional pavement surfaces, because not only you're reducing the challenges that you would be facing with the impermeable surfaces because of this rainfall and runoff issues, but you're also reusing that water. And it's a pavement that has much more reduced maintenance in comparison to traditional pavement surfaces. So essentially you're saving on that front. And as you said, you're also saving in terms of material because you're using less material in comparison to the traditional surfaces. So in its, if you consider the whole life of the pavement structure, it has lower cost than the traditional surfaces.
And importantly, in the built environment, it also seems to produce a lot less noise than traditional concrete when vehicles run over it, which is a very nice added bonus. That was Alelia Keir and Imperial College London on Keircrete. Finally today, we're going to tackle one of the more left-field attempts to tackle climate change. Sean Fitzgerald from the University of Cambridge's Centre for Climate Repair is behind one such project with aspirations to refreeze the Arctic and preserve the ice there, buying us time while we come up with other ways to stabilise the climate.
Every scenario considered by the IPCC in their most recent report considers a large suite of measures on emissions reduction complemented by greenhouse gas removal. And while some of those actually do see us below 1.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century, the sad fact is that every scenario that they now consider sees us exceeding 1.5 degrees centigrade in the interim period. And we're greatly concerned about the changes which are going to be unleashed on the planet. In other words, the loss of ice on Greenland, the loss of ice on Antarctica. And therefore, what we're trying to do is equip ourselves with knowledge so that a society can make an informed decision as to whether these engineering solutions could be put in place in order to buy us more time to get greenhouse gas levels down whilst keeping the ice on Antarctica and the ice on Greenland, for example.
In a nutshell, are you basically advocating for refreezing Greenland?
Well, I'm certainly advocating for doing everything that we can to keep the ice on Greenland and the ice on Antarctica.
Greenland has lost billions of tonnes of water, provoking some of the sea level rise that you've just been referring to. So this is not a small, trivial thing to just keep the ice there. How do you anticipate trying to do this?
In general terms, there are two big factors that determine the temperature of the Earth and therefore the rate of, for example, melting of ice on Greenland. The first is the amount of radiation coming in from the sun. And what we can do is look at measures to reduce the amount of the sun's radiation that actually gets down to the Earth's surface. And those approaches are termed solar radiation modification. They can include things, for example, by emulating the effects of volcanoes. Volcanoes such as Mount Pinatubo, when it erupted, it spewed about 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. That then reacted with water vapor to form little droplets of sulfuric acid. And those little droplets of sulfuric acid were of the right length scale, diameter, that they were able to reflect a very small portion of the sun's radiation. And the second big idea is whether you can actually get more of the Earth to radiate heat out at night and actually help, therefore, in terms of the overall radiation balance over either a year or certainly over a day.
Let's start with the first of those ideas. You've presumably done more than just back-of-the-envelope calculations on what this is going to take. So hit me with the hard facts. How much cloud forcing or seeding have we got to do in order to preserve the Arctic?
something like 10 million tons per year of sulfur dioxide being injected into the stratosphere could indeed cool the Earth by circa 1 degree Kelvin. And that's a really useful benchmark. Now, what does that really look like? In other words, how would you get 10 million tons of sulfur dioxide up into the stratosphere from an engineering deliverability point of view? That's thousands of flights of aircraft a day in order to get to that sort of kind of delivery schedule.
The other idea you proposed was to try to get the Earth to get rid of more heat. Tell us a bit more about that, because I haven't heard anyone say anything about that.
Well, one of the things that we are looking at is something called sea ice thickening. The first effect of this is that how can you get more sea ice to grow in the Arctic winter? And the reason why you might want to do that and get the ice to be thicker is that the ice will actually then last longer over the Arctic summer and therefore reflect more of the sun's radiation as it impacts on that ice in the Arctic summer. But let's just think about what's going on in the Arctic winter. What you're really doing is if you're getting more ice to form in the Arctic winter, given there's more freezing, then the latent heat of solidification has got to go somewhere. And ultimately what you're doing then is actually getting that latent heat of solidification, freezing, to be radiated out to space in the Arctic winter. And the way that you do that potentially is by pumping seawater, not very far, but pumping it up from under the ice to on top of the ice and getting the freezing process to then occur on top of the ice. The top surface of the ice in the winter is, say, let's say minus 20 degrees centigrade. If you've pumped the water on top of the surface, then by definition, it's liquid water. And the temperature is no longer minus 20 degrees centigrade. The temperature is, let's say, minus 1.5 degrees centigrade. But that difference in temperature actually results in an increase in the rate at which heat is being radiated out to space in the Arctic winter.
And how much energy have we got to expend pumping water in order to get a net cooling effect?
There are two flavours of this particular problem that we're looking at. The first is where you're pumping seawater on top of the sea ice in order to make that new sea ice on top of existing sea ice. The second idea that we're looking at is where, in fact, all you're doing is pumping enough water on top of the sea ice to consolidate any snow that then falls naturally on the sea ice. And if you can turn that snow into solid ice, snow is a ridiculously good insulator, and therefore you've increased the conductivity of the overall matrix. And what that means is that just pumping enough water to convert the snow into solid ice, you've increased the rate at which new sea ice can form naturally. And, you know, that will require far less pumping, far less energy for a given amount of new sea ice that can accumulate naturally. That one excites me greatly, but we're looking at both of these approaches, Chris.
And how does this go down when you present these ideas, both at home, but also when you go to conferences or international meetings and so on, and you talk to the community about these ideas? How does this go down with fellow engineers, climate scientists, etc.?
I get a mixed response, to be quite straight with you. Those who have an open mind as to, look, we're not in a good place, but we need to be learning more so that society can make more informed decisions, are really eager to help. Whereas there are those who think these sorts of ideas are a distraction. And whilst I accept that that is a viewpoint, I don't agree that that is the cause of the lack of progress that we have made on emissions reduction to date. When we go and talk to people about why we've been making such paltry progress on emissions reduction, it's very, very rare that I hear, in fact, I've never heard the argument being that, oh, well, it's because climate engineering is going to get us out of this hole. We need to make much more progress on emissions reduction. And emissions reduction is necessary, but not sufficient, in my view.
A fascinating set of ideas there from Sean Fitzgerald at the University of Cambridge's Centre for Climate Repair. So, as Mark Maslin emphasised at the start of the programme, tackling the climate crisis is actually a massive engineering challenge. But talking to our guests this week, we can see the scientists do have all kinds of interesting, ambitious and exciting irons in the fire. The threat from climate change is driving ingenuity and forcing us to develop more environmentally sound ways to exist, things that arguably we should probably have done years ago. Nevertheless, the threat remains very real. The impact that climate change will have on our lives is potentially massive, and we're also going to need social engineers to help us cope with many of the human problems that this is going to inevitably create. But that is a question for a future programme. Next time, we're going to be examining cancer vaccines, including their origins, how they work, and whether they might be one of the best tools yet in our armoury to help us fight off cancer. If you'd like to join in the conversation, do drop us a line. It's 5lifescience@bbc.co.uk. In the meantime, from me, Chris Smith, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Good morning, and hello, hope you're doing okay. Sunday morning, it's 5 Live Breakfast. It's me, Chris Warburton, and...
And me, Bliss Hannah. Good morning, good to be with you.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot to talk about. Labour conference, we're going to be talking about the match. Manchester City against Arsenal, of course, which you can hear live on 5 Live as we approach 7 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And the news headlines. The British boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF World Heavyweight title with a fifth round knockdown of two-time former unified champion Anthony Joshua. James Gregg will bring us all the latest on that fight in the Sport Bulletin shortly.
But first, Sir Keir Starmer says it is his job to do something about leaks coming from the government after the salary of his chief advisor Sue Gray was made public earlier this week. He was speaking to The Observer ahead of the start of the Labour Party conference. The PM said leaks damage everybody and that it was his responsibility to solve the problem. Alex Forsyth is our political correspondent.
Because of the week that the party's had, this week we've had all of that drip, drip constantly of stories about, you know, the gifts of clothing, the gifts of spectacles, the tickets to the football matches, the pay of Sue Gray. I think that has just set quite a difficult tone going into this conference. And there's like a consciousness that they need to find a way to deal with that so that they can get on with talking about what it is that they want to, which is what Labour plans to do in government.
The Crown Prosecution Service says it twice failed to bring charges against the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Fresh allegations are being made about the late billionaire, sparked by dozens of women coming forward to say they were raped or sexually assaulted by him. Nick Johnson reports.
In 2009, the Crown Prosecution Service was handed a file of evidence by police who'd investigated claims that Mr. Al-Fayed had sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl in the boardroom at Harrods. The CPS declined to bring charges. Now, as first reported by the Sunday Times, it's been confirmed the CPS also decided in 2015 not to prosecute the billionaire after reviewing an allegation of rape. In a statement, the CPS said that in both cases, it did not feel confident there was a realistic prospect of conviction.
The Iranian-backed group Hezbollah says it has launched rockets at an Israeli military complex in the northern city of Haifa in an initial response to the targeting of communication devices in Lebanon last week. 39 people were killed and thousands of others were wounded when their pagers and walkie-talkies exploded. Hezbollah has blamed the attacks on Israel, which hasn't commented. The Israeli